In an article published this week on the internet on a site called Human Events Online, Senator James Inhofe, Republican from Oklahoma, said, quote, "Much of the debate over global warming is predicated on fear rather than science. I called the threat of catastrophic global warming the greatest hoax ever perpetuated on the American people. I highly recommend Michael Crichton's book, State of Fear, to all of my colleagues," unquote. Well, are the threats posed by global warming just a scheme cooked up by tree-hugging scientists and environmentalists to get grant money? Is the Earth really getting warmer, but not as warm as environmentalists want you to think? Can it be that carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas, is on the rise, most likely because of human activity, but that the link between it and the rising temperatures is not really scientifically justifiable? Well, that's the premise of State of Fear by author Michael Crichton. At least that's how I read it. And if not, he can help explain it to us because he's going to join us by telephone. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. And I want to welcome back to Science Friday. Michael, welcome to Science Friday again.
Thank you, Eric. Nice to talk to you.
I imagine you're happy to get the support of Senator Inhofe.
Actually, you know, if I believe it's the case that he had given speeches to the Senate saying more or less that a number of years ago, so I suppose it's not surprising. One of the odd things about the politics of all this is that prior to the publication of the book, more or less everybody knew how responses would come down.
Uh-huh. Do you agree it's the greatest hoax ever perpetuated on the American people?
Oh, no, I don't. I would have to take a moment to try and think of what the greatest hoax was. But I don't actually view it in those terms, and I don't think the book says that.
The book is pretty scathing against environmentalists. You'd have to agree on that.
Yeah, well, I mean,
you wrote it.
Very clearly my view that we need a strong and effective and science-based environmental movement, and we don't have it. And I think that we are risking significant environmental degradation as a result of very outmoded thinking. For example, you know very well that since, say, the first Earth Day in 1970, when people were first made aware of environmental concerns in a major way, and I would say that awareness, which has occurred in our lifetime, is one of the, perhaps the most important thing that environmentalists have done so far. But since that time, there has been a revolution in science and a revolution in ecology. And unfortunately, most environmental activist thinking doesn't take that into account. So from my point of view, putting aside the specific question of global warming, these organizations are in large part very far behind the times.
You don't think the National Academy of Sciences and the other major institutions that study the environment are up with it these days? You think they're way behind? In fact, you say in your book that what you think is that you think we need more people working in the field, in actual environment, fewer people behind computer screens. We need more scientists. Where are we going to get the money to pay for those scientists?
Well, we're spending a fair amount of money now on various investigations of climate science, but the concern that I have is an awful lot of it, or a different way to put it, is that since the organization of the IPCC, which is the UN organization of scientists and bureaucrats, which intermittently examines the state of the climate, what's happened is that there has been a privileging, to use that word, of computer models over efforts to actually acquire data directly from the environment.
Why write a fictional book about it? Why don't you take your evidence and publish it in a journal and duke it out the way the other scientists do?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is I'm not a climate scientist, and what I've done here, how I look at what I've done, is to say this is an outsider's view. You know, this is somebody who, and by the way, I came to this kind of accidentally. I mean, I was reading a certain article in the front of the book of a science journal, and it didn't make a lot of sense, and I kept reading it, and finally I began to say, why, what's going on? It was a one-page article, and I thought, usually what happens when you see a short piece of writing like this that is self-contradictory is that the writer wants to say something that they can't say, and I thought, well, the only thing this particular writer could want to say is that global warming is not as convincing as we think. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. But at a certain point between books, when I had a chance, I went and started looking at the temperature record. And all that data is online. I encourage every interested person to go and look for themselves. I mean, you don't have to take my assessment of this. Go and see what you think. And I was very surprised at what I found.
So you were surprised, and you put a lot of the data in the book. And I have to say, in reading the book, I can see where it's been selectively edited from going through all your notes and looking on the web and looking for them. And it is a novel, after all. Are you saying then that all the countries that signed the Kyoto Treaty and even the president's own cabinet now, which has come back and said to him that there is evidence of global warming and it's caused by human activity, all these people are misguided, and all the scientists who've studied these things, who are climate scientists, who've spent their career studying these, they're all wrong.
Well, let's not conflate a whole lot of things.
Well, basically, you're saying.
Hold on. Let me untangle it for you, okay? I mean, this is a show in which presumably we can go into a certain amount of detail.
Sure.
So let's try and do that. The claim of global. First of all, as we know, there's been a rise in temperature since about 1850, when the world as a whole came out of what's called the Little Ice Age, and I believe it's correct to say that in the last century, the total rise is estimated to be in the area of half a degree to three-quarters of a degree. That's what's on Jim Hansen's website right now.
I think the National Academy raised it a couple of years ago.
To what?
To about a degree.
Okay. I mean, let's say
to the layperson, that sounds like nothing.
No, we're not going to, let's not go to that. Let's go to exactly what happened. From 1900 to 1940, there was an increase of, if it's a degree, then that's probably half a degree. Although that coincides with a rise in carbon dioxide as measured from ice measurements, mm-hmm. I think it's correct to say that most scientists would say that that is not carbon dioxide driven. Okay, so that's a natural increase up to 1940 because we haven't had enough major industrialization to really assess that rise as human-induced as opposed to naturally induced. Okay, now from 1940 to 1970, carbon dioxide went up, temperatures actually went down. And as you'll recall, in the 1970 period, a great many articles were written about the coming ice age. From 1970 or 1975, somewhere in there onward, temperatures began to rise again. And they have risen steadily in conjunction with carbon dioxide. And it's on the basis of that 30-35-year trend that the concern about global warming is actually centered.
Mm-hmm. And
okay.
So?
So the first thing is, no one is denying that temperature is increasing. It is. And the question is, what is exactly is taking place? And that's a much more complex issue than many people are talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the most interesting recent things has to do with whether or not the correction for land use in general and the urban heat island effect in particular is adequate. What happens is that various temperature stations, which over, say, the course of the 20th century, have become increasingly localized in, or have been localized in, what are increasingly urban settings. and therefore are increasingly warm. Those temperature records from those stations are reduced by a factor. And in most ways that this is done, the reduction is based on change in population. In other words, there's an assumption that as population goes up, the cities are larger, they're hotter, and the temperature is reduced in that way. In the last few years, there was quite influential study that had to do with the city of Vienna, Austria, which since 1950 has had no population.
Dr. Crichton, I can't. We're going to have to read your book because we can't go through all the evidence.
Okay.
But and because we are running out of time, do you have another It seems like because you're getting involved in you know correcting science. Have you got something else you're going to be working on for your next book? And maybe it would be Darwinism or something like that.
What, you mean?
Evolution?
Ira, nobody disagrees with Darwinism.
Oh, no. You haven't been reading the school papers lately. I got to go, but we'll have you back on to talk more about this. We've run out of time. It's tsunami week this week, and we've got a lot of stuff to cover. I appreciate you taking time to talk with us. Michael Crichton, author of the new book, State of Fear. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the tsunami and the ecological effects that that are actually hindering a recovery of the tsunami victims. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.